The image of Russian President Vladimir Putin is one of his being rugged, athletic, leader of a country which, when confronted by domestic terrorism, takes a hard and effective stand against it. Problem with an image is that quite often it's manufactured to hide reality. My next guest unplugs that image in order to reveal the reality of Vladimir Putin, where, well, opponents seem to have sudden endings to their lives in a variety of ways. She's one of the most informed go-to experts when it comes to Russian politics, ever written 5 books. Along with multiple articles and papers on the subject, her book is Orders to Kill, The Putin Regime and Political Murder, Amy Knight. Thank you so much for being here today, Amy.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Amy's website, Amy Knight, KNIGHT.org. You can check out, get your copy of Orders to Kill and Amy's other work. I guess just as a foundation point for the conversation, what you write about in Orders to Kill is not something new in the world of Russian leadership and politics.
No. It is not, except that I think the phenomenon of having a leader, actually the Kremlin leader, ordering or having these crimes orchestrated is a little bit different than what it was in the Soviet period. I'm not talking about the Stalin period. I mean, we all know that Stalin murdered thousands and thousands of people. But in the Soviet period, when the Communist Party pretty much ruled the country, there wasn't any real need to secretly murder critics, because the leadership had complete control, and there was no freedom of the press, no nothing. So it's a little bit different now.
But by how much? Because as you write about in Orders to Kill, when it comes to security, when it comes to media, it doesn't happen, it doesn't get done unless Putin gives a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
Well, what I was trying to say is that Mr. Putin, he needs to kill his critics occasionally, because he needs to send a message that he wants to intimidate political opposition and critical journalists. No, my only point was that under the Soviets, they didn't really need to do that, because they were completely a totalitarian society. Russia does not really have free elections. It's media. The television is controlled by the state. But there still is more freedom than there was in the Soviet period. And so that means that some of Putin's critics actually get heard, and he has to get rid of them.
And with that process of getting rid of critics, is it something that he's actively involved with, or is it much like a mafia godfather who just gives the blessing for it to get done, but then wants to stay off the radar screen and not get blood on their hands?
Well, that's a very good question. In these cases, there's not a smoking gun. And Putin would obviously merely suggest to somebody that he'd like to see a certain critic disappear. And that's all it takes, a wink and a nod. And it's very interesting, because one of the cases that comes to mind is the 2006 murder of Alexander Litvinenko in London. I don't know if you remember, he was poisoned by polonium, poisoning. And the British government took a long time to get to the bottom of this case, many years. But in the end, the High Court judge said that it was very clear that two men from the Russian FSB, the KGB successors, did do the killing. And the judge then said, probably Putin was behind it. So that little probably always is there, because, of course, we don't have the smoking gun.
And you mentioned how that incident took place in London, that death took place in London. That's really the frightening part, because when you introduce this idea or the topic to someone in a conversation and say, hey, read this book, Orders to Kill, the assumption would be all these deaths take place on Russian soil. That's not true.
No, it's not. And you know, in the case of what happened in London, the two killers who were hired by the Kremlin, they bungled things so badly. They spread polonium-210 all over in London buses and taxis and hotel rooms, and it's a very lethal poison. So the British government actually called it an act of terrorism.
Talking with Amy Knight, Orders to Kill, The Putin Regime and Political Murder, amyknight.org. is the website, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. The killings, is there a pattern to them? Is it done in a clandestine way? And when they're committed, obviously it's a crime with visible results. Somebody has to be prosecuted / arrested for these acts, don't they? Otherwise, wouldn't the people have been an uproar?
That's a very good question, and I'll tell you what happens. Pretty much in every case, the Russian authorities will round up people and arrest them. They're usually from the North Caucasus, usually Chechens, because, you know, the Russians have been fighting a long war against Chechnya, and the Chechens are always kind of the enemy, the boogeymen. So what happens is these people are rounded up. There have, in a lot of the cases, there have been trials. And, in fact, often these were the actual trigger men. But the problem is nobody ever finds out who ordered the killing, who orchestrated it. And that's just for some reason those crimes are never solved. And the reason being that the Kremlin controls the law enforcement and the security. So they take their orders from the Kremlin. So they control the entire investigation.
One would think, too, that given the level of control that Vladimir Putin has in so many outlets, is his dominance as strong as the image? Going back to my introduction, I guess, image isn't always the reality. Or is he paranoid and protective to the point where he feels this has to be done so his dominance doesn't get a crack in it?
I think it's more the latter. I think that he realizes that his popularity, and I should say the polls show him at over 80%, but his popularity is based on the fact that the Russian state controls the television, and most Russians watch television for their news, although that's changing and they're now looking at the internet. But I think Mr. Putin realizes that at its core, this support is something that could be dissolved pretty easily, and that's what frightens him. The protests that broke out in Russia, those really unnerved the Kremlin, and that could happen again because people are not very happy about their economic situation, and they realize that the Kremlin elite is very, very wealthy, and that there's a lot of corruption. So I think that Mr. Putin is rightly nervous about the possibility that, you know, something could happen, that there'd be more protests. And also, I think he's concerned about members of his elite sometimes. You know, maybe one of them would turn against him. So, yes, he's always on guard.
You go off the idea, at least the concept of the book In Orders to Kill, as we wrap up our time here with Amy Knight and her book Orders to Kill, the Putin Regime and Political Murder, here on Issues and Ideas. And instead of talking directly about political assassination, you bring in the Boston Marathon bombings and the Sarnoff brothers, which, as I said to you off the air, too, this chapter alone could be a book on its own, right, because of... It's almost like I started to visualize one of those flow charts that when they used to investigate the mafia, you used to have that picture connected to that, to that, to that, to that, and that, and you wind up with a frightening conclusion sometimes. And you, again, through, I guess we would say, civil court speaking, preponderance of the evidence, there is a Russian footprint on what took place that day in Boston.
Yes. And I have to say, I'm one of the very few people who's raised questions about that. But to me, there's a lot of reason to suggest that the Russians encouraged Tamerlane, the older brother, to engage in radicalism. I'll just quickly explain why, because the Russians had their own problem with terrorism, and they were about to have the Olympics in Sochi. People were worried about the Russian ability to handle terrorist attacks within their own country. And so when the Boston bombings occurred, they were able to say, oh, look, the U.S. has this problem as well. And by the way, we were right all along. The Chechens are really enemies. I bring up the Chechens because the Tsarnaev brothers were from the North Caucasus, and their father was Chechen. So basically what happened was Tamerlane went over to Russia unexplained, completely unexplained, and the U.S. authorities never knew about this visit. He spent 6 months there, not long before the bombings. And I am positive that the security services, the FSB, knew full well that he was there. And I think that there's a very good possibility that they encouraged him to go back to the U.S. and carry out a terrorist attack.
Plus the fact that the FSB was watching Tamerlane all the time he was here in the U.S. So, again, it becomes the coin toss. Were they watching him to make sure they were ready for him when he came back, or watching him to make sure that he was going to do what they were hoping he would do over here?
Yes, you're absolutely right. They were watching Tamerlane. He was on their radar screen, and they did contact the FBI about him. But I'm beginning to think that that was more of a fishing expedition on the part of the FSB. And I think that, you know, in the end, they decided that they would encourage him, as I say, to become so radicalized that he, together with his brother, would commit this awful act of terrorism in Boston.
The book is Orders to Kill, The Putin Regime and Political Murder, amyknight.org. If you were reading it and thinking it was fiction, you'd wait for it to be a movie, but this is true to life and death situations. And when next time you see Vladimir Putin calm, quietly speaking, promising good things to happen, well, the reality is quite the different picture, as Amy writes, and no doubt as long reported on as well. Amy Knight, anyone who brings the truth forward to break a false image is someone who should be respected, and you have indeed done that. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.